welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The Brothers Anderson are... This is Eric.
And by the way, you know, when you're telling these little stories, here's a good idea. Have a point. It makes it so much more interesting for the listener.
This is Brother Jay.
You ask me if I have a God complex. Let me tell you something. I am God.
This is Drew.
There is a storm coming like nothing you have ever seen. And not a one of you is prepared for it.
So sit back, close your eyes, and let us take you away. Unless you're driving, in which case keep your eyes open and watch the road and, you know, anyway. Welcome, this is Eric.
This is Brother Jay.
And this is Drew.
And tonight we're going to talk about the 1960 masterpiece by Alfred Hitchcock, Psycho. One of my favorite movies.
How many watermelons died making this movie?
Were they watermelons?
Cassava.
Yeah, cassavas.
So, everybody had seen it, is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Long time ago.
Okay. Yeah, I think I saw it inappropriately young with you.
Excellent. It's keeping the streak
so
alive.
I was likely even inappropriately younger.
I remember watching it and being not understanding what was going on until it was too late, and then just being horrified, and then years later couldn't actually sit through it because the memories were so bad. I knew it was coming. It just scared me. I didn't watch it for a long time.
Yeah, and I watched it when I was a real little kid, and then I watched it again when the Gus Van Sant remake came out to compare them, which turned out to be a waste of time. And so it's been since then, since the last time I've seen it.
I have not seen the remake. So you're saying it's a good thing I haven't seen the remake.
It's not good or bad. It's just about a shot-for-shot remake.
With Vince Vaughn and Anne Heche.
Mm-hmm. So the point was just to put stars with current draw. Was it modernized at all?
Barely. This is my memory. I mean, I remember not understanding what the point of the remake was.
And I don't think either of them were stars at the time. I think it was just Gus Van Sant's seeing whether he could do it or not, wanting to pay homage.
But is it really paying homage if you end up being just bland and a repeat?
Well, turns out no. It's like Tom Savini did A Night of the Living Dead in 1980, I think. Very similar situation.
Have you seen the remake, Eric?
I have not seen the whole thing. I saw maybe like the first half and just pulled the plug, but it was a long time ago. I mean, I'm sure everybody's technically good.
Well, everybody had a pulse.
I mean, all the actors that could, you know, I mean, Anne Heche and Vince Vaughn are both technically good actors, so.
Yeah, I don't think I could name a single movie either of them's been in that I remember. I know I've seen movies with them in it, but with most actors, I could say, oh, I've seen at least this movie with them in it, but both Vince Vaughn and Anne Heche, I couldn't tell you a movie they've been in.
Wag the Dog for Anne Heche, right?
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, and of course, Swingers for Vince Vaughn, as well as all the Owen Wilson buddy movies. So, has everybody seen Psycho in the last couple of weeks?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Brother Jay, seeing it the most recent time, what's your takeaway this time?
I think it still greatly holds up. You have to suspend a little bit of your disbelief, or perhaps my overactive imagination, because you have to be able to tell yourself this movie was made in a different time, and yes, the technology's changed, and so there's some things that don't quite ring fully true. But if you put yourself in the mindset of when this movie was made and when it came out, it's a pretty amazing film. It's amazingly well shot. I mean, visually, it's a stunning film. It gives you a real sense of the community or the whole set gives you a real sense of the surroundings. You get a very good kind of environment to kind of follow the characters in. And they develop, you know, they get some good character development. So it was longer than I remember. In rewatch, it seemed a little slow in the beginning, but I think that's because I'm comparing it to more modern movies, which seem a lot faster paced. This was a lot more deliberate.
True.
I did not enjoy watching this movie. I expected to, but I didn't. I think the movie is well crafted. And I like a lot of the things they do. I like the bait and switch about what the movie appears to be about versus what it ends up being about. And I think everybody had good performances for the most part. Norman Bates was amazing, especially compared to his job on Folks. Nah, but he was really, really good. But I think without the shock value of the twist, I think it loses a lot of its sting. You know, if you know what's going on. And then I think the ending was really mishandled. I guess we can talk about it more when we get there. But it's just too long. It was too long.
See, I think of this film like watching a like close-up magic, like sleight of hand. Like, you know that it's a trick. You know that there is a trick that's being played on you, and yet I enjoyed every minute of it. I was a little bit surprised on this viewing that the beginning is pretty deliberately paced. It's pretty slow, but it is. And I was also a little bit shocked on how unsexy Janet Leigh was as Marion Crane. I mean, she's wearing underwears, but I mean, her, like, because she's got this tension from the very beginning, you know, she actually is sort of a sad character in this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
I found that really good. And this movie had a lot of acting with eyes. When she's driving the car, you know, that whole like inner monologue, I thought was great.
I love the beginning. I love the time spent on the beginning, all the tension that's built up about whether or not she's going to get away with her heist. When it turns out it doesn't matter at all.
I know. I love
that. But like the whole thing with the cop, I love the time that they spent building up your expectations that it's going to be that kind of movie. So I appreciated it, but knowing what was going to happen, how deliberately paced it was made it feel like work.
Oh yeah, it's setting you up. I mean, it is totally mm-hmm. setting you up for a different movie.
Yeah, you're really being spoon-fed a path.
Yeah, it wasn't even Scream, which was sort of a play on this, where they kill off Drew Barrymore in the first beginning of the movie, because you knew that Scream was going to be a slasher movie. You didn't know this was. Mm-hmm. I mean, this really isn't a slasher movie, but this is a horror movie.
Yeah,
it just. And
I would have really appreciated a lot more if I hadn't already known the twist.
Is it really a horror movie, or is it a suspense movie?
It's a suspense movie. It starts out as sort of like a caper thriller kind of movie.
Like I don't classify it as a horror movie because I don't see anything super. To me, horror is more supernatural or fantastical. Suspense is much more real world, practical effect kind of movie, in my opinion. So to me, I don't classify this as a horror. I classify this as a suspense.
Yep, I mean it's definitely got that, and the horror really is all about music and camera direction.
And sound effects.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, visual effects, too, but sound effects for sure.
Yeah, there's a lot of tricks that he does, you know, to make this movie, to put you as the audience, like, off kilter. Like, he does those big shots from above, just like we saw in Dial M for Murder. And, you know, he does... The one effect I didn't like was when Martin Balsam falls backwards down the stairs.
Where he just kind of floats down.
Yeah, I thought that was cheesy. You know, I mean, it was just a, like, I don't like that kind of camera trick. I know it's the sort of thing that Spike Lee does, and, you know, it's, we've already seen it in, like, Vertigo and stuff, but.
Well, but at the time it was new.
Oh, yeah. No, it was. Just don't happen to like it. But other than that, I thought, so if you've never seen this movie, do yourself a favor and watch this movie. I can't imagine how it's not been spoiled for you at this point. But truly, it's out there. Go watch it. It's black and white.
It's been spoiled for you if you listened to the High Anxiety episode.
It's true, yes. Yeah, it's been spoiled for you if you watched The Simpsons. I mean, it's all over culture.
Yeah, this movie has been ripped off, stolen from, alluded to, and talked about in any number of other TV movie, podcast, interview, show, bad TV host. I mean, there's a plethora of ways this movie has been utilized as a vehicle for conversation. So I'd be surprised, with the exception of the newer generations, I would be surprised if most people haven't watched this.
Now, did you watch this with Jesse?
Yes.
And had he been spoiled?
No. He had never seen it before.
So how did that go?
He was watching it, and I was trying to stay focused on the movie, but I was also, I would look over and kind of surreptitiously see what his reactions were to see where he was at. So I was trying not to do that too much because I didn't want to influence his opinion by, ooh, the good part's coming. So I tried to avoid all of that. But I tried to have some observation. So I think the first part of the movie, he was interested, but not quite sure what was going on. Because the first third to half of the movie is a little confusing when you're trying to figure out where the story's going.
Well, the pivot is like halfway in.
Yeah. Well, and then when she, you know, when she's killed in the shower... he was noticeably, what's the word? Not shocked, but it was very...
It's a dramatic tone shift, yeah.
Well, it's absolutely, it's a paradigm shift to the movie, because you're expecting one thing, and then you're going in a different direction. And he and I discussed this weekend. I'd asked him if he had figured out the twist at the end before he got it, or did it really shock him? And he said he didn't see the twist coming. He didn't see it at the end. So when the end hit, he was floored and impressed, and he really enjoyed it.
Awesome. That's nice to hear. So the movie starts out in a Phoenix hotel room. I mean, this is a movie that tells you what the time and the place. Right down to the day. It's like, what, December 13th or something. And it's in the Phoenix hotel room on a Friday afternoon. Marion Crane, played by Janet Leigh, who we know from The Manchurian Candidate, and her out-of-town lover, Sam Loomis, played by John Gavin from Spartacus, she had taken a long lunch to go have some mattress time with her beau. And he is divorced and paying alimony, and is in debt, and what, runs a hardware store or something, in a town a couple hours away. So he comes to Phoenix to do business, and then they do a little business, but she wants to make it like legitimate, and he doesn't want to do that until he's free of his debts and burdens and whatever.
And you get to see both of his feet are on the floor.
Oh, you know, that's the thing, is that this actually, like, she's wearing, like, a bra and panties in the beginning of this.
That was scandalous.
Yeah, it's very scandalous. Which is why I said, you know, watching it now, I'm like, she's not super sexy because she's not happy this entire movie. Like, she never smiles during this movie. Because she really wants Sam Loomis to marry her, but he's not going to do it. And she's living with her sister and working in a real estate office, a job she clearly doesn't love. So they have a conversation about her wanting to get married, and he doesn't want to do it till the timing's right. So she goes back to work, and she's got a great equivalent of a cube mate who's like the most annoying coworker in a pretty fun way.
Who is played by?
Played by, let's see, is that Mrs. Kravitz? No. Played by?
Hitchcock's daughter.
Oh, Pat Hitchcock, maybe? She's, again, a little bit of comic relief because she's just, you know, she's sort of, you know, where Marion Crane is a little bit uptight and put together, she is more like snarky.
Patricia Hitchcock.
Patricia. So Marion gets back to work, and her boss comes in with the very drunk out-of-town client who buys a house for $40,000 in cash and is waving this money around big time.
Kind of asking for it, if you ask me.
Oh, yeah. He's all chatting her up and waving the money around and talking about how he buys happiness. Or he, what is it? He buys away unhappiness. So his boss, who is getting roped into going out drinking with this guy, doesn't want this money even in the office safe. He wants the money taken to the bank right away. And since Marion's got one of her headaches, her post-coital headaches, she wants to take the day off anyway. So she takes the money with the errand to go to the bank, but doesn't go to the bank. Instead, she decides she's going to blow town and go see Sam. Because this $40,000 that just fell into her lap is now going to solve all their problems. So she's driving out of town, and there's the great Bernard Herrmann violins going on. Well, cellos too, but it's that great Psycho theme. The jaunty, jolly version of the Psycho theme. And but, you know, the violins is and the, I guess all the strings are creating this kind of like building tension.
Well, violins and violence.
Yeah, exactly. And she, you know, she takes a drive out of town. She stops at the light and sees her boss, and the boss sees her. So in a very Hitchcockian way, the audience knows exactly what's going to happen. It's just a matter of when it's going to happen, we think. So she's driving out of town on her way to Fairvale, California, to meet up with Sam, who doesn't know she's coming, doesn't know any of this.
And she has a lot of money in cash.
Yes.
I mean, did you happen to look up what $40,000 in 1960 was the equivalent of?
No. What is it?
It's about $325,000 today.
Wow. Yeah. So that's...
Yeah. In her purse, in cash.
Exactly. And she knows she stole this money. And she knows she's fleeing the town. So she can think everybody else knows, but she, of course, doesn't know for sure. So her long drive, and it's rainy, and she pulls over and takes a nap by the side of the road and is woken up by a highway patrolman with the most intimidating sunglasses ever.
He's got those Terminator 2 Robert Patrick glasses, right?
That's great. It's the cop glasses.
Yeah.
So. He is the bad guy in another movie.
Yes. Yes, indeed. And you know, you kind of think he's maybe the bad guy in this movie, too.
Yeah, because you don't know what to think.
Yeah. And he, you know, so they have a conversation where she is very, very suspiciously nervous. And he doesn't have anything to charge her with or a reason to detain her further.
And she's pretty pushy, too.
Oh, yeah. No, she's super nervous and acting weird. But again, he doesn't have any reason to stop her. So she drives off. But of course, he follows her because he's a highway patrolman. He could drive the highway all day long. That's what he gets paid for. So he follows her all the way to the nearest stop along the way. And she pulls into a used car lot where she meets up with John Anderson, my favorite car salesman. California Charlie, I think is his name. And he is great. He's using all his salesman talk on her, and she doesn't care. Like, I want to see the car. I want to buy the car. I'll give you cash for the car. And so several times he says, wow, it's the first time I've ever been pressured into selling a car. So, again, it's all very tension building.
Yeah, and he was definitely the comic relief in the first part of the movie.
Yeah, and, you know, the patrolman, like, drives onto the car lot as she's driving out. After, like, looking at her menacingly from across the street for her whole transaction. So, she is not making a covert getaway as much as she's just, you know, trying to put space, distance between herself and Phoenix or the law or whatever. But there's a big rainstorm, and she can't really see very clearly. Which is another part of the movie that made me very nervous. I don't like driving through that kind of rain. Like, where you can't see shit.
Yep.
Because, you know, at least in Alaska, when it snows like that, you know, like big snow blowing whiteout kind of thing, it's scary, but at least it's light. When it's rainy like that, which we don't really get in Anchorage as much, it's dark, and that makes it a little bit worse. But anyway.
So, when all my time living in Alaska, I never experienced the really heavy, scary, can't-see rain. It was only when I moved to Oregon and I was driving from Seattle to Portland and I was in a snow/rainstorm that the rain was so hard, I literally could not see the front of the hood of the vehicle. And it was terrifying because not only could I not see the front of the vehicle, I couldn't see the vehicles in front of me. So, if they had stopped, nah, I'd just been dead.
Yeah, so at that somewhere point, else. Especially if you have $325,000 in your purse, you might want to pull off anyway and find the nearest place to rent a room. So she does. She's on the old highway. And she sees the Bates Motel. And, you know, it's a regular old, like, old-timey motel, but place you see in Anchorage and probably everywhere else in America. Sort of sketchy. If you tripped over a meth pipe, you wouldn't be all that surprised. But this is 1960, so you're not thinking that. You're just thinking, you know. Yeah, and this is where we meet Norman Bates, Anthony Perkins, who we know from Folks. Also, Murder on the Orient Express and Catch 22.
By the way, remaking Murder on the Orient Express.
I want to know why we haven't already watched Murder on the Orient Express.
I wasn't sure anybody would want to watch any of the Agatha Christie movies.
Murder on the Orient Express is a fucking star-studded extravaganza.
Oh, yeah. No. Death on the Nile. I mean, there's a bunch of them we could watch.
But specifically, Murder on the Orient Express is... I mean, I was looking at the cast. It's astounding.
Yeah, well, my recollection is that it's a great movie.
Oh, it may be not great, but we should definitely put it on the calendar. I'm just saying.
Have you read the Agatha Christie books?
I've read all of the Agatha Christie books.
I've only read a couple, because our mom was a big, or probably is a big, she's still with us, big Agatha Christie fan. I don't know how much of an Agatha Christie fan she is, but like those novels and the Travis McGee books were a staple around the Anderson house in the 70s and early 80s.
I enjoy the Agatha Christie novels quite a lot. So it started my like of detective novels in general. And the nice thing with the Agatha Christie novels is you were introduced into different investigators. So you didn't necessarily have to be stuck with the same characters, the same core character. You know, you had Hercule Poirot and you had Jane Marple, and so you had different storylines. But the nice part was that you also had kind of a familiar entry character, so some of the character foreshadowing that you had, the character development, you had a little bit of that existing, so if you hadn't read the previous books, you could get into this, but if you had read them, you kind of had a little better understanding of the unisphere that they exist in.
It's going on the calendar, just saying.
Sure. I like them. I'm interested to see what happens with the remake.
Do we have any idea what the cast of the remake is?
Yeah, I saw the preview.
Yeah, man.
It was
Gal Gadot
It's got Ray and Aaron Burr in it.
It's got Raymond Burr and Aaron Burr?
No, it's got Ray.
Jamie Foxx.
Johnny Depp.
Oh, dear. Yeah, that, you know, I'm sorry.
Michelle Pfeiffer. Kenneth Branagh. Willem Dafoe. Penelope Cruz.
Oh, my.
Judi Dench. Derek Jacobi.
Daisy Ridley, Leslie Odom Jr.
Yeah.
And Kenneth Branagh is Poirot, right?
Michelle Pfeiffer isn't necessarily a draw. Like, she would have been 20 years ago, but not so much now. I mean, she should be fine. Kenneth Branagh is actually kind of a negative draw for me. Maybe I was burned by Dead Again.
I would say, after watching him in Dunkirk, I would say that you need to get past Dead Again.
There's a trailer out for this movie, Murder on the Orient Express.
I saw it when we went and watched whatever Jesse and I went and saw recently.
One more time quickly, after Michelle Pfeiffer. Oh, Willem Dafoe. Willem Dafoe is also one of those guys that I don't think is a plus. He is a weirdo.
Oh, come on. But he's our kind of weirdo.
Great. It looks fantastic.
My son, what have you done? I'm just going to point that out. This, I know you guys haven't seen it, but it is not a great example of a Willem Dafoe, Michael Shannon movie.
Is Poirot supposed to be like an arrogant jerk?
Poirot is the arrogant French guy from Murder by Death. Like that exact character, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay, well. All right, well, I think Kenneth Branagh seems to be doing a good job in the trailer.
Yeah, Poirot isn't particularly likable, right?
No, he's kind of a smug bastard.
Yeah, but in his own inimitable way. Well, except if he's being imitated by Kenneth Branagh.
But he's French-Belgian, so.
Yes. Anyway, so back to Anthony Perkins. Anthony Perkins is so great as Norman Bates. I mean, he's really amazing. Is. It's just
he's got creepy down.
It's stunning. I mean, he's at one time like sort of charming, kind of a Dobie Gillis kind of oh shucks sort of guy, and on the other hand, he's super creepy. And especially at the end, just like that last scene of him just looking at the camera. Is great. Mm-hmm. I mean, talk about like making use of his face angles and shadows. There's a bunch of publicity pictures too from this movie where he's like standing by the big stuffed owl and the shadows are such that it really looks sinister.
He does such a great job of like transitioning from being like super friendly and charming to being kind of nervous to being sinister really organically and seamlessly all in the span of one scene. He can do that and he does it effectively.
Oh yeah.
He is certainly the star of this movie and I can see why even if he didn't have very many hits after this, why he was always a recognizable name.
Well, he was very typecast by this movie.
Yeah, this movie didn't really do him any favors. Except that, of course, it made him a big name. I mean, hopefully it made him a lot of money. But in those days, probably not.
And he was the eating of the candy corn throughout the movie.
Was that what it was? I mean, I know he's eating candy.
It was candy corn. Yeah. It was Anthony Perkins. It was his addition to the movie.
It's a great little thing. Absolutely. And the whole interaction between Marianne and Norman is pretty great. You know, they're a little heavy-handed with it because they really want to, you know, it's like on one hand you'd be like, oh, this is just like unbelievably spreading it on thick. But when you realize that a lot of it is just a big misdirection, I thought it was masterful. the way they're talking around each of them being trapped.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just great. I think it's, you know, and during the conversation, she makes a realization that, well, okay, you know, I don't want to be trapped like this my whole life, so I'll try to get myself out of this jam. So she's intending to go back with the money and try to make amends. Oh, we think. At least that's her thought, her final thought of the evening. But Norman is all, like, starts out as a little awkward, and then it gets downright pervy with the hole in the wall.
Well, but before that, he was a creepy taxidermy guy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's that parlor is just freaky. Have you ever been in a setting where like, you're overwhelmed by the accoutrement?
Oh, yes.
When we went to, I visited Terry and Rob in England, and we were driving to the Cornish coast, and we stopped, I can't remember the little town on the way, but you had to drive, it was actually Halloween, and you had to drive like through these back like farm roads or whatever that were basically one lane, and it was raining, and it was all very, it added to a lot of nervousness. Like, I think Rob was particularly freaked out because we'd see a sign saying whatever the name of the town was, like 1 mile away, right? Ever. So we'd drive for like 2 miles and then see another sign that says the town, 1 mile the other way. And we're like, we didn't pass anything this entire 2 miles. So where is this town? When we had called and found it or whatever, I was tired and whatever and making jokes in the back seat about how this is how horror movies start when the car was break down and we're out in the middle of nowhere and we don't know where we are and have no cell phone. Rob did not like that train of thought. Poor Terry was like trying to shut me up in a subtle way while also saying, oh, no, we'll be fine. Yeah. But when we got to this little place, it was a bed and breakfast, and walking through, it was 8:30 at night or something. So it was way past when we were supposed to be there, but walking through their entryway, there was their collection of ranch, tackle and metal parts and whips and stuff, all hanging from the walls. I'm sure in a nice decorative way, but it was dark outside, and so it was sort of dark inside. And it was all these like metal and leather horse things on the wall. I'm like, oh yeah, this is where we're gonna die.
Are you expecting to go into your room and see a Catherine wheel?
Oh, it's a Catherine wheel. What's a Catherine wheel?
It's a medieval torture device.
Okay, is that where you have to fuck a horse? No.
What?
Never mind.
What? Why would you go for?
No, wasn't that the Russian leader? Was it Catherine the Great?
Catherine the Great.
Yeah, there's an apocryphal story about she died because she was having sex with a horse.
I was not aware of that, yes. But thank you for putting that into my head.
We call that fake news. Sad nowadays, but. Okay, so, sorry, back to the... Anybody else have an accoutrement story? Decorator from hell?
No, nobody is going to be able to top your sexing a horse story.
That was... Hey, Jason brought up the having sex with a horse. I just... I was just talking about the horse stuff on the walls.
No, you were the only one who talked about having sex with a horse.
Okay, all right.
Roll the tape back.
Anyway, I love the little line about how, you know, we all go a little mad sometimes. Like, that should be one of the greatest quotes ever. And so Marion starts to do a little math on some paper about, because she spent $700 on this car. So she's got to figure out how to get that $700 back to make it $40,000 so she can take it back to Phoenix. And she decides to take a shower before she goes to bed. And this is just, I mean, it's just a masterfully shot piece of film. Saul Bass, who is the guy that did the titles for this movie and for a lot of Hitchcock movies, is thought to have a lot to do with this particular part of direction. putting the scene together because he's a visual artist. I think in his later years, he was basically telling stories in as much as he was like sitting in the director's chair directing the entire action, which may have been a little bit of a stretch. Sorry.
I'm sending you a picture of the Catherine. Hold on 1 second.
Yeah, I don't open these things around my family. So just anyway.
You don't open these things around your family, but you'll openly talk about like horse sex.
Well, not around. Well, anyway, so I don't mean you family. I mean you guys are rough and ready. So anyway, so
no one's ready for that.
Okay. Yeah.
All right.
I think my giddy up and go kind of got up and went.
A couple of episodes I told you about brucellosis. It's a real thing. Be careful. Play safe. So, yeah. So what do you think most recently? What do you think of the shower scene?
I thought it was still terrifying. It made me jump a little. But also, existing in a house that has a shower curtain, it makes me paranoid.
Well, for not showing anything, it just is the most terrifying thing.
It's a masterful scene. I mean, it's well earned that it's one of the most iconic scenes in film history. It's from the way they restage the camera so that it's sort of from the point of view of the wall opposite the shower curtain, just before the attack. All the way to the end where you see the blood going down the drain. It's a fantastic shot.
Oh, it's got everything. It's got the curtain coming down, like pulling the rings off of the curtain rod.
Mm-hmm.
Great. The, the spiraling away from her eye is great. The fact that a significant portion of the audience believes that A, you see the knife enter her at some point during the thing, and B, think the movie was in color because they remember the blood going down the drain. I mean, right there, that's a testament to how well this is shot, because neither of those things are true.
Also, Mel Brooks is a genius.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. 100%. Yeah, so that's where this movie, this is the turn. This is where the movie becomes a different kind of movie. And you have to kind of get a restart, because as it turns out, arguably the female lead in this movie is Vera Miles, who plays Lila Crane, Marion's sister.
I would love to be able to experience this unspoiled for the first time. I think that would be amazing.
Oh, absolutely. It's one of those Sixth Sense things. Hitchcock made a big deal about, because at the time, you know, it was just routine to buy a ticket for a movie and you could enter the movie at any time and basically watch it for as long as you wanted. And so people routinely would go catch the last half of a movie and then watch the first half next or whatever. That was not happening. And it was great, you know, granted, it was a publicity thing also. But, you know, they had it so that the movie would start like 15 minutes apart on different theaters or whatever, but you had to stand in line and you were not allowed access to the theater until the movie started. And as soon as the movie started, no one else was allowed in. I mean, that's like brilliant. Also, I think there was a little thing saying, don't tell your friends the twist.
Yeah, there was a placard.
Which is great. This made a shit ton of money.
That's good, because the studio didn't want to make it, right? Didn't Hitchcock put up a lot of the money himself?
The novel by Robert Bloch, or novella maybe, because it wasn't very long, was not this nuanced. It was about a killer transvestite, and this is not what this movie is about. In fact, the guy from Kolchak at the end explains very carefully that's not what this is about.
Yeah, and just about ruins the ending.
Well, we'll talk.
So this movie was budgeted at just under $1 million, and the gross was $32 million.
I would say that's a success.
Well, and that's the original gross. The estimated gross to date as of 2007 shows it's over $55 million.
It's a classic. It's an absolute classic. But what about the investigator Arbogast? A, I love his name. B, I love the actor, Martin Balsam. We know him from 12 Angry Men, Breakfast at Tiffany's, All the President's Men, Murder on the Orient Express also, The Taking of Pelham 123, Catch 22, and Archie Bunker's Place, among probably another 150 other things. But so now it's like a different kind of cat and mouse game where we're trying to figure out what happened to poor Marion. And of course, we know as the audience. And, you know, the Detective Arbogast, the private investigator, and is snooping around and ends up getting closer and closer and closer and then finally too close.
Well, and this was the part of the movie where when he pushed the car into the lagoon or swamp or whatever it was, when I saw this the first time, my original thought, it's amazing to me to this day how vivid watching this movie the first time stuck with me, because it all came back to me when I watched it. But when I watched this movie, I remember thinking when he pushed the car into the lagoon, how many times before he had done that.
Oh, yeah. Because
in my mind, this wasn't the first.
Well, exactly. There's no way of knowing. You have no way.
I did like the little pause and the look on his face when the car stopped sinking.
Oh, it's great. I mean, that's, again, one of those great things that Hitchcock will do. Like, just enough that it ratchets up the tension more, but not so much that you're groaning. At least I wasn't groaning. But yeah, so then we discovered that maybe, so there is this sick old lady that lives in Norman's house. Now Jesse didn't realize that it was Norman all along?
Nope, did not.
That was great. And what about the sheriff? I love the sheriff that they get out of bed. Like, John McIntyre is the actor, and he's been in everything. Definitely has one of those cowboy faces.
He has no interest in doing sheriff duties at that time of night.
Well, that's not what sheriffing is about. You know, like after all that that unpleasantness that happened 10 years ago, people just need to leave Norman alone.
Yeah. The murder-suicide of...
Mrs. Bates.
The mother and the mother's boyfriend.
Unfortunate for a young boy to handle it. So, although we don't know how young he really is, right?
But not particularly.
He's got a really young face. But that was also a great, great little, really subtle misdirection when the boyfriend and the sister are talking to the sheriff, and just incredulous that he thinks the mother's dead because they saw her. And so as an audience, you start to question if that really was the mother, then the sheriff and his wife kind of chuckle that if that's not the mother, then who'd they bury?
Yeah.
Which, if you're the audience, you think, oh, I know what happened now. They, Norman or somebody killed, or the mother probably killed some other lady, and they staged it and buried a victim.
But you still don't know that at this point.
Nope.
Yeah. Yeah, so yada yada. Marion's sister and the boyfriend go up to the motel because Arbogast doesn't come back after he encounters Mother. And again, the camera angle is really super high. And it's a pretty brilliant scene up until the time that he falls down the stairs. I hate that part of it. I wish we could skip past part of that. But it's really pretty great. Another piece of like chilling, not quite as good as a shower scene, but still pretty fun. And then we have the boyfriend. I'm going to yada yada a little bit because, this is the good part. This is where we find out that, and of course, Norman has, after the sheriff calls Norman to find out what's going on, Norman takes Mother and hides her down in the cellar so nobody finds her. But it's not till Vera Miles discovers that mom is actually, she is indeed Norman Bates' mom. And she is a stunningly horrifying mummified or taxidermied woman. You know, what with like the bare light bulb going back and forth and it's great. I mean, it really is a chilling piece of practical effects there.
I don't really understand how the chair swung around, but otherwise, yeah. It was a great scene. It was a great reveal.
Yeah. So at the so now this is the part where eventually Sam ends up as mother, or as Norman dressed as his mother, is going to stab Lila. Sam comes in and subdues him, and he does sort of a Star Trek red shirt kind of collapse, but
it is so weird. It's a weird bit of physical acting right there.
Yeah, and then we go to the courthouse or the police department, and this is where the psychiatrist, Simon Oakland, who plays Vincenzo in Kolchak, so I love him. He's so great. But he was also in West Side Story and Black Sheep Squadron. And Drew, so tell us about how this ruins the movie for you.
Oh, this is terrible. It would have been a much better ending if they had cut almost directly to subduing Norman in the basement to like a really brief, like 20-second explanation of Norman being crazy. And then cut to Norman's little inner monologue and stare at the camera. That would have been a great ending. But instead, we get like, I didn't actually time it, but it felt, what was it, 6 minutes, 7 minutes?
Something like
really
that.
Really long.
Yeah, it did go on.
It was a full Q&A between the cast and Vincenzo.
Yeah, of just this dude brought in for no other reason than to spoon feed the audience exposition about what was happening with Norman's psychology. And I don't know why they did it. It wasn't necessary. It didn't add anything to the movie. It really ground it to a halt. At that point, you just want to get to the resolution. You want to see what's going on with Norman. Because you did not get any time with Norman as the killer. Like, that was a big reveal, and then it's over. And so you want to get back to him, and instead there's this random new character telling you all about his other personalities and how they took over and how he's not really a transvestite. And I don't get it. I don't get why it's in there.
Well, I know that in the time, like in the 50s, they had a lot of those, like everything from exploitation movies from the 50s, but a lot of the, it was basically just an excuse to see like boobs, but it was under the guise of, we're telling you this story, this is how, like, sort of like a Reefer Madness thing where, you know, where smoking marijuana leads to horrible things, but really the movie is really about it's just showing boobs all over the place. And titillating the audience. So, and plus, it's also kind of an Agatha Christie thing too, where you have this mystery, and at the end, the clever person describes how it was all done. So I think it was probably a trope of the time. No,
I don't know. I think it would have been way creepier to not explain it. then you can just walk out being like, oh man, that was fucked up.
But don't you think audiences at that time might not? Audiences at the time might not have come back for other Hitchcock movies had that been the case. They needed kind of this expanded explanation so that they could kind of have a cooling down at the end of the movie, kind of like they were having a final stretch out session before they quit their workout.
Well, it kind of legitimizes the story from being purely like a sex maniac transvestite killer into being a more explainable mentally ill person. So it makes it less seedy, if that makes sense.
I can see that.
But there was no sex in this movie.
Well, exactly.
I mean, Norman didn't even seem particularly interested when he was watching Marion undress through the peephole.
Yeah, but again, I don't know. I don't want to suggest that the audiences of 1960 were less sophisticated than we are, but I don't know. They went out of their way to talk about how Norman was not a transvestite.
Yeah, it was weird.
Well, I think they wanted to differentiate it from, a sexual deviant thing, like a morality play. Like, if he wasn't a transvestite, he wouldn't be a killer. Like, I don't know from the documentaries or whatever whether this is addressed at all. Addressed.
But I'm bummed.
But they, I mean, definitely they went out of their way to add this. This was not like an afterthought. You're right. This is like minutes upon minutes of making sure that the audience knows exactly what was going on.
Yeah, I mean, with you watching it, you know, this being one of your favorite movies, what do you think about this scene?
I thought it was fine. I thought it was a nice way to, because if you're like, what the heck has been happening? This kind of tells you, oh, wait, hold on. You know, like it allows you to still feel sorry for Norman until the very end when you hear Norman's mother's voice in his head. And what did you think about the skull at the end?
That's a nice little effect.
Yeah, I thought it was
quite creepy.
It was cheap, but it was also, like, it would have been super cheap if it wasn't just more than a couple little frames.
Yeah, it was quick enough that it was subtle.
Yeah. Also, I really like the final image where they're towing the Marion's car out of the bog. I think this is great. Mm-hmm. It's just like, it doesn't have to be there, but it gives you like a sense of like finality to the whole thing. And I just liked it. I really do like this movie quite a bit. Like, I was really harsh on Vertigo, still am. But in this, this movie has, I mean, you kind of, like, there are no characters in this movie that I don't feel sorry for or feel a goodwill toward at some point. You know, I mean, I don't think, I mean, Norman Bates is the bad guy, but he doesn't, to me, he doesn't come off being, you know, like a monster as much as a severely troubled person. And Marion, of course, is very flawed, but, you know, she comes off as being repentant at the end and not really, you know, I mean, she's like, everybody's got that kind of feeling going on sometimes. Or what would you do if somebody dropped $325,000in 2017 money in your lap and that kind of money could significantly change your life? It's a morality thing. Like, you know, that's why you're allowed to kill her, because it's a morality play. Except that's not what this movie's about. So,
no, I think that final scene with Norman, with him just looking at the camera, is so great.
With the fly?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome.
And the way he's holding his arm out from the blanket, it looks really almost inhuman. Like, it's at a weird angle, and
oh, yeah.
The whole thing is great. The whole scene is creepy from top to bottom. And the way he looks at the camera is really chilling. Because you don't get to see you get to see creepy Norman. You don't get to see like chilling, scary Norman, except for just a brief second, you know, before he's subdued by the boyfriend in a really awkward, kind of hilarious way. So having that last shot of like super terrifying, creepy, murder Norman is a great capper to the movie.
So, have you guys seen any of the four sequels, three sequels?
I seem to recall watching the sequels again with you, inappropriately young.
We've seen them all, yes. Because of you.
Yeah, excellent. I think so.
Well, they're all although, bad.
I think I saw the fourth one on my own, because that came out quite a bit later.
Yeah, part two was Jennifer Tilly.
Yeah, that's the one that's, I think, actually scared worse.
Meg Tilly, not Jennifer. Meg Tilly. Meg, right. Yeah.
Meg Tilly.
Part three was, of course, the Jeff Fahey vehicle, which is a great 80s movie. Horrible, but fun. And then part four was, I think, an HBO movie that does has the radio host talking to Norman. And then it flashes back to the mom and it gives you all that creepy incest stuff that I think they probably explore.
Diane Lane, right?
Oh, maybe. Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's funny. This movie was nothing about sex. And every other movie, well, maybe two. I haven't seen two recently, but I remember mostly at one point Meg Tilly dressing up as mother. But that wasn't sexy. I don't think, yeah, that's...
I remember there being a body in the ice machine in two.
Maybe it was three, though, actually. I think it was the body in the ice machine was three.
I just remember, like, the strange clawing at the basement window.
Yeah, see, great visuals on these sequels, but... yeah.
It stuck with me for a while, that's for sure.
In one of them, Norman either isn't or doesn't think he's the killer, right?
Oh, I don't remember. Maybe two?
I think in two, they're setting him up. I think Tilly's setting him up, if I remember.
Yeah, like he got out of the mental institution and then people start dying around him and he starts freaking out about it a little bit.
It's coming back to me, yes. I think you're right.
Now declared legally sane, Norman Bates is released from a mental institution after spending 22 years in confinement over the protests of Marion Crane's sister, Lila Loomis, who insists that he's still a killer, and the court's indifference to his victims by releasing him is a gross miscarriage of justice.
Lila married Sam? Interesting. Well, in the upcoming weeks, we'll talk about all the Psycho sequels. Okay, we're not going to do that. So, any other trivia before we go on to the verdict? I mean, there's like books and documentaries and an entire podcast devoted to trivia about this movie. So perhaps we should defer to the experts on this one. But, Brother Jay, your verdict?
This is still a good movie to me. I liked it. It still scared me. So that, to me, is kind of an effective barometer of the quality of the craftsmanship of the movie. So, also, I hadn't seen it in some time, so that probably contributed somewhat. But when you take in combination the visuals and the plot development and the misdirection, I would give it an A-.
Brother Drew, was it worth it?
If you haven't seen this movie, you have to see this movie. But if you've already seen it, I don't know that there's much to get out of a rewatch. You know, if you know the twist, there's a significant amount of diminishing returns for repeated watchings. But it's a well-made movie. It's iconic. Everybody does a great job. So it's definitely worth it, especially if you haven't seen it. But if you have... For me, it felt like work to get through it again.
Fair enough. I still think it's one of my favorite movies. I highly recommend it. Makes me happy to have talked about it. So thank you for putting up with that. What's on our calendar for next week? I mean, Drew, you're wrong. Like, I can point that out, but oh well.
Thank you for your opinion. You're wrong.
Yeah, what's next week's movie?
Tuesday is being John Malkovich.
Oh, Tuesday. Okay. Anyway. So, Brother Jay, housekeeping?
The parents were here for a few days, so that was fun.
Did they have a good time, do you think?
I think so. I'm exhausted. I think they probably are, too. It was a lot of, you know, we did a lot of stuff. For not doing a lot of stuff, we did a lot of stuff. We really didn't have much on the agenda, but we did a fair bit of running around and got mom some shopping in that she really wanted to do in Portland. And so it was good. You know, we went out to eat a couple times, so that was fun too. Last night we went to a fun little fondue restaurant, so that was exciting because it was a place none of us had ever been to before. So it's always scary to go to a new place, but it was good food, so it worked out really well.
Can I ask a very Portlandian question?
Yeah.
How many fondue restaurants are there in Portland?
Three or four.
Awesome.
I think you took me and Jennifer to a fondue restaurant back in the day.
Oh, I want to go to a fondue restaurant someday, but yeah.
You think I took you to find a restaurant when you were here?
Yes.
I think we went to Gustav's, where they had cheese fondue.
Oh, and sausages.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. That sounds right.
Yeah. And so, yeah, they have a bit of a fondue, but this is a full-on fondue restaurant called Urban Fondue. They actually...
Hipster fondue.
It was amazing because they ended up offering us, it's on the menu, but they explained that it was a, you can go the 3-course meal option, which is as a family, as a table, you get to choose your entree. You get to choose 2 side dishes. Then you get a cheese. So you start with a cheese fondue, you get your entree fondue, and then you get dessert fondue. But there were 12 sauces that went with the protein slash meal fondue.
Like dipping and sauces?
Yes. And some of those were like the most amazing things I've ever tasted in my lifetime. But you had to be careful because they line up these 12 little ramekins in rows of 4 for the whole table to share. And they give you a couple cards and they're like, okay, well, they're in order of the card, so just don't mix them up.
No,
it was fine, but it just required a little bit of decoding because we were having, as the night progressed, we were having some math issues and we were tired and, so we had 3 different pots of court bouillon on the table, so different flavors. And then you get this tray of protein with meat. I got pork and beef, which also came with like tortellini and vegetables that you all put in the fondue pot. But the cheese fondue that we started with was pretty amazing. By the end of the meal, we were just stuffed, which is good. I think we all pretty much agreed next time if we went, which we will definitely go again. We would probably skip the main course. We would just have the cheese fondue and the dessert fondue because it was more than enough with that.
Yeah, why not?
Because the protein fondue, the main entree, having been spoiled by our parents with the peanut oil fondue, having a court bouillon, having a flavored bouillon fondue is fine. It cooks the food, but it cooks it at a much lower temperature, which is the boiling point of water, basically, 200 degrees, as opposed to, peanut oil, which was probably 375 degrees. So where you get that nice sear and then it cooks, so it's hot in the center, but it's not overcooked and dry. This cooked very differently because it was a much lower temperature. Like, so
poaching your protein?
It was just a different experience. It had a different texture and different flavor than I was probably unfairly comparing. It was good, but it just wasn't as good as I remember from the danger zone of having hot pots on the parents' table with extension cords strung through the leaf.
I still have nightmares about that.
So, the scary thing is when
you were the one trapped against the
exactly,
wall.
Trapped in the back. Fat guy trapped in the back. We're jumping up would not add safety to the situation.
Well, the amazing thing is they have these 3 pots of really hot bouillon on the table with sterno underneath them. Which is at any time possibly dangerous for any of us because I am super klutzy, certainly. So I have to be careful about that.
Is it called court bouillon? Like, is the name that vague because they just reuse it all?
I don't know. I don't know. It's French cookie. They probably do. It's probably, they soak their socks in it and they strain it and it goes back on the table. But
it's full of snails and testes.
The waiter, one of the waiter staff, come over to clear the table after the dinner course to get ready for dessert course. Of course, he has this serving tray in his hand and he reaches over to get one of the pots of still hot bouillon and put it on his tray over and behind mother's head and back, which gave me Mozzie's flashbacks of my junior prom. So that was a little frightening, but it turned out well and we overate as usual, but it was a good time. The weather's been great here, although it was too damn hot yesterday. And it was okay today. It was better today. It was cooler. So at least the folks got some good weather. They had a rental car, which was a little Mitsubishi something. So it wasn't bad. So they stayed at a decent hotel, and I think they had a fun time. They were up in Seattle for Dad's reunion, so that was good. But so all in all, I think it was a success. We dropped them off at the airport today and kind of hung out until they went through security. And they had a pretty uneventful time getting home. So
excellent.
Everything everything seems okay. They didn't have any major traumas, so that's good.
How was the eclipse?
The eclipse was weird. I'm trying not to sound like a dick. I was nonplussed by it because I don't really care. We have science and technology, and we don't live in caves anymore, and we understand what happens with the Earth rotating in the universe and the sun and the moon getting in each other's way. So people make this romantic mysticism of it, but it's just one thing getting in the way of the other. So I don't know. I don't think it's as big a deal to me. And admittedly, it's important to some people, so great, but I don't understand the reason for a million people who have to have descended in the Portland, well, not the Portland, in the Oregon area to try and see this event that lasts all of 5 minutes. So, some people felt it was life affirming and life changing. Good for them, but, perhaps their lives need some better meaning. Just my opinion. It was weird. Certainly it was weird to have it go dark in the morning, and it did get pitch black.
Really?
It also, there, oh yeah.
You had like the totality?
Yeah, well, in Portland, in the areas I was in, it was 99.6.
Wow.
So close enough. It got black. The parking lights in the parking lot across the street turned on after about a minute. It got cold. That was the most amazing thing. It got cold.
Oh, that's wild.
Yeah, it dropped probably 10 degrees in the 5 minutes there was no sun. It was kind of spooky. And the moon shadows were really kind of weird, seeing the kind of the weird shadows that fall through. So that was kind of fun.
But I was wondering what was following me.
Very, very good. So, but again, it was this thing that happened. A lot of people in the office and a lot of people in the clinic, you know, all business halted for like 20 minutes while people got ready. And then after the fact, because people were talking about it. So it's just kind of, and then people had tried to start leaving the area in Southern Oregon. And in some cases it took them what would have taken an hour, 10 minute drive, took some people 9 hours. And then there were people bitching and complaining because they had booked flights to leave that day and then couldn't make their flights because they were stuck in traffic, and they were all upset and butthurt. And like, well, you chose to get a flight immediately after this huge event, which wasn't original thinking on your part. So perhaps you should have planned better before deciding that you would be able to get to the airport, you know, amazingly fast in the midst of a giant traffic jam.
Yeah, you dumbass eclipse mystic.
Exactly.
Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on our new voicemail account to leave voice messages. Or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts. Dial it already.